Today's interview is with Sarah Heusler. So I first met Sarah at my retreat, which I ran last month. And if you've been listening to the last few free flows, you'll realize that it was quite a life-changing, fun experience for me and hopefully for those amazing women who came along who I know are listening to this. Hello, you wonderful human beings. And as soon as I met Sarah, I was like, I have to get you on Carlosophies. We did this and we refer to it through the interview. So I thought I'd explain it before we dive in. We ran a basket weaving workshop, and Sarah, being a recovering overachiever, was the first person to finish her basket, and it looked amazing. And, you know, there I am still like at the beginning phases, being kind to myself. But the reason I wanted to get Sarah on actually was because she is a chronic overachiever, and really the place that led her to was burnout. And I'm finding this really common actually amongst women who are high achievers. They just keep going and keep going and keep going and keep going, striving for more and more and more and more. And then something happens and the bubble kind of bursts and they're left picking up the pieces of their life and their health. And I think these are really important conversations to have, because if you're on that path of continually trying to reach expectations that are outside of yourself, God, I know this all too well, we need to stop, take some time out and redefine what success means to us, which was the very reason I started this podcast in the first place, because I had reached that point. And I really want others not have to go through that big fucking fat mess. So, enough jabbering on by me. Really happy to introduce you to Sarah Heusler, occupational therapist, amazing human being, and owner of Bloom Wellbeing and the Meaningful Motherhood podcast. Shut up, Carly. In the nicest possible way. Here's Sarah.
Welcome to Carlosophy's Stories Behind Success. I'm Carly Nimmo. It's so easy to fall into comparisonitis as an entrepreneur, and it can be paralyzing. In my own journey, I've come to understand that regardless of your level of success, fame, or fortune, we're all suffering from the same stories of fear, struggle, and failure. So let's talk about it.
So basically, I was a complete nerd at high school. I was just the book nerd, but I've said this before, I wasn't nerdy enough to be picked on by the cool kids, but I certainly wasn't cool enough to be part of their gang either. But I was really happy, you know. I loved school and I was good at school. And, you know, for a kid growing up in the 80s, that meant life was pretty easy. So you did well at school and you went to uni and you did all those things. And, you know, I just got along with it. I wanted to be a doctor originally, or a lawyer. I think I just watched one too many episodes of Ally McBeal and decided I wanted to be a lawyer. But in the end, I decided to become an occupational therapist. And to be honest, it was totally random how I became an OT. I was still kind of set on becoming a doctor, but I missed out by a couple of points and I knew I was probably going to miss out. So I was talking to my best friend and her neighbor was an OT, and she said, why don't you become an occupational therapist? I went, okay, I don't know what that is, but I'll put it on the form. And that's what happened. So yeah, went through my OT training and, you know, just had a really easy, lovely kind of career in OT and did that for a few years and then quickly got sick of it. So something that you'll probably see through my story is that I have a pretty short attention span for things. About 5 or 6 years is my limit.
Better than me.
Yeah. I know. And it's one of those things, isn't it, that I guess our generation, it was the first that could come along and kind of go, you know, it's okay. You don't have to stay with the same company for 30 years. You can move and you can change. And, you know, I probably only stayed with the original company that I got work with straight after uni. I was working for a corporate, a Commonwealth government agency, because I moved around within that agency a lot. So I moved towns and I moved locations and I moved into different fields of work as well. But I was doing a lot of work in what's called vocational rehab, so helping workers to get back to work after injury, which I loved. But then I got stuck into a lot of work cover work, so looking at, you know, people who were injured on the job and that kind of thing. And that just really, I hated it. It just really stuck me, and I was doing so much paperwork and I really wasn't helping anyone. I was just actually pushing papers around and making phone calls to doctors and lawyers, and it just sucked. So I got burnt out of that and decided I'm not going to be an occupational therapist anymore. I do not want to do this anymore. Didn't really think about, you know, going into a different field of OT at that stage. I just went, stuff it, I'm going to do something completely different, and decided to become a journalist. So that's what I did. I went back to uni and studied a grad dip in journalism part-time and got myself a job in the field of sort of communications and journalism, and loved that. Loved that job and loved, you know, hearing people's stories and telling people's stories. And then I sort of met my husband and we got married and we moved to a little town called Mount Gambier, and I was working in the paper there. And then somehow I kind of fell back into OT. The paper that I was working for had a change of ownership and a change of editorship, and really just didn't get along at all with the new editor that was there. And he was making lots of big changes for the sake of making changes, which I just didn't agree with, and was causing lots and lots of ruffles in the system, in the business that we were in. And so I went, I don't want to be here anymore. I'm going to move. And I got approached by the local private high school to come and work for them. And I really wanted to work for them in their communications department, but they knew that I had been an OT and they wanted me to come and work for them as an OT. So that's how I got back into OT, after swearing black and blue that I would never be an OT ever again. And it's just fortunate that I got back in there, because now I know that, you know, this is the right sort of space for me to be in. But I was only there at that school for a couple of years, and then my husband and I moved to Queensland, promptly got pregnant, and we moved to Queensland after getting married. And when I was moving, I got a job as an OT up in the hospital system up there and had my babies. And that's when I started to meet mums. And up until that point, I had never really met mums, but I'd never really had much to do with them. It was the first time I'd really had a lot to do with kids myself. And what I really noticed was that there was a lot of mums that were really sick, that were really unwell, that were injured physically, you know, with wrist problems, back problems, neck problems, pelvic floor problems, and injured emotionally as well, you know, postnatal depression and anxiety and stress and isolation and all that kind of stuff. And I started to realize that my occupational therapy skills could help these people. You know, I could actually work with them, and the skills that I have as a clinical practitioner could help these people. So I decided one day that I'd start my own business, because it's going to be super easy and super fun. Isn't that how it always goes? And of course, you know, I decided, yep, I'll start my own business. After the birth of my second baby, we moved home to Adelaide from Queensland. So I had like a 10-month-old baby and a 2-year-old child who was about to turn 3. That was the point where I said, well, I either have to go back to work for someone else or I start my own business. So I'll do it now, thinking that it was the perfect timing, when in reality it was the shittest timing ever.
I know. What is it that makes people think, oh, yeah, I had a baby, just had a baby, now need to use this time to start my own business?
I know. It happens so often. And to be really honest, you know, it's one of the things that really annoys me now when I see it, because I see it everywhere, that women are being fed this lie that they can, you know, I call it the mumpreneur myth, that they can have a baby and build a business and create this beautiful, lovely lifestyle, and it's going to be easy. And that's the image that gets put out there on social media and on the internet and through lots of these kind of, you know, multi-level marketing stuff that just really irritates me, because I see so many women get trapped into it. And for me, it was all self-directed. You know, I decided myself to do it. But then I do see now that so many women get drawn into it or dragged into it at the time when, you know, we probably don't want to be making massive changes, because we've already had massive changes happen to us. So,
and
yeah,
it's just so much like you're just learning how to be a new version of you and how life with kids works and who you are as a mum. And then you throw in this weird starting your own business thing, which is a personal development journey in itself.
Absolutely.
It's, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, my story is obviously very different in that I was already established when I had Mabel, but then I have done a lot of new things since having her, but that's just my nature. Like that's the person that I am. I'm always doing new things and trying new things. But you know, I've struggled as someone who was already established in self-employment. I struggle with that. I just can't imagine what it's like to start from scratch when you're also raising a child. It's like you've got, and at times you just feel completely torn between the two things too, right? Like there's guilt attached to following your dreams and blah, blah, blah. It's just a shit show, really.
Absolutely. And especially because, you know, that I guess that early parenthood and maternity leave time is a time in a woman's life when she's probably the first time in her adult life that she's not working and not earning an income and is now kind of all of a sudden reliant on someone else for income. So then you add starting a business to the mix. And I mean, the majority of businesses don't make money in the first few years. And that's another lie we get told as well. So, you know, for 3 or 4 years, you're battling to replace a wage that you might have had, and you're spending twice as many hours to earn half as much money. And then there's all the added pressures on, you know, your relationship if you're in one with a partner about, well, why aren't you earning any money? You know, then I'm all of a sudden that person's the primary breadwinner. And then you can get so much resentment around, well, I'm earning all this money, but you're spending all this time working and not earning any money. And it's just, it's just horrible. So, yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it was really interesting. And, yeah, so like I said, I started this business and I was working part-time for someone else at the time because I went, I'm not going to make any money for a while. I'll need to do a little bit of part-time work. So I got some part-time work as an OT and I was working 3 days in the week in the city for the government. So I was getting on the train at 8, getting home at 6. Those 3 days, my kids were in daycare or kindy at that stage, and I was building my business. So I'd rebranded from my personal name to my business name, Bloom Wellbeing. So I was building a new website. I was starting an online program in stress management. Ha. That's the greatest irony of all. And I was also doing my Pilates rehabilitation training. So I had all these things going on at the one time, and it was just simply way too fucking much. I can't say it any clearer than that. And in the moment, I was like, no, it's fine. It's fine. It's fine. I can do it. It's just for another few months. It's just until Christmas. It's just until the kids go back to school. It's just until this. It's just until that. And my husband was like, I don't know, Sarah, like, you know, you're doing too much, you know. And I was. So I'd, you know, be at work for my 8 or 9 hours and get home and put the kids to bed and do the dinner and clean the house. And then I'd get on the computer at 8 or 9 p.m. and be on the computer, laptop, till like 1 or 2 on the couch, and then I'd go to bed and I'd get up and do it all again. So doing those ridiculous 16, 17, 18-hour days.
Totally sustainable long-term.
I know, and it was just ridiculous. And it was really at that point where I realized, gosh, this is complete do as I say, not as I do at this point, because I remember really vividly sitting there at about midnight one night typing into my laptop that it's really important for your health to turn the computer off by 10 p.m. I'm like, what's going on here? You know, I'm trying to, you know, give people ways of better living their lives, but I'm not following any of my own advice. And so I pushed, but I was determined to make this business work because I'd invested so much time and energy into it. And I think the other thing as well is that as women, we see our businesses as extensions of ourselves. So we need our businesses to succeed and to be wonderful and to be loved by others, because if they're not, it means that we are not successful or loved by others. So I really fell into that trap of seeing the business as an extension of who I was and a reflection of the value of myself as a human being. So I pushed and I pushed and I pushed and I pushed to get it done. And I had that driving force as well around, you know, being in a relatively new field. So, you know, working with mums and with women in the field of occupational therapy was something very new. So there was not a lot of us working in that field at the time, and there still isn't. But when I started, there was barely anyone. So I was, you know, constantly searching for other people in that field, and then I was constantly creating stuff, and I was constantly educating, you know, my clients and other practitioners and other health professionals about what OT could do in this field and how we could support mums and how we could support people in the postnatal time frame.
And so how does that look? How does occupational therapy support mums?
Yeah, so what we do basically is you know, OT or occupational therapy is a profession, it's a health profession, and we support people to live, you know, full and meaningful and functional lives regardless of kind of what their health or medical situation is. So OTs work in lots of different fields. So we might work in like stroke rehab, or we might work with children who have developmental delays, or we might work in mental health. And what we do with each of those clients, with each of our clients, is really dependent on what they want to do. So we will do a really thorough assessment at the start of seeing someone new and figure it out what it is that's affecting their life. So whether it's a health condition or a disability or an injury, and how that's affecting their life. So what is it stopping them from doing that they really want to do? And then we work with that person to find ways around that. So there's lots of problem solving, there's lots of coming up with different solutions to things. You have to have a really great understanding of a really broad range of health conditions, so emotional health and physical health and how they link with each other. And what we do is we use what we call occupation. So we use activities. So we get people doing things. So we figure out what's missing from people's lives, and we help them to put that stuff back into their life. So it's not just necessarily just a talking therapy, or it's not just necessarily like a physical therapy where we're setting up exercise programs. It's really taking a really broad holistic look at their whole life and what they're doing in that time, how they're spending their time, and figuring out, okay, what's missing? You know, what is it that means that you're really unhappy, or you're not fulfilling your full meaning in your life, and how can we get you back into doing activities that you love and that you want to do? What are the barriers to getting you back to those activities, and how can we overcome those barriers? So it's sometimes really difficult to explain occupational therapy, so because it is so broad. And that's simultaneously what makes it a really fun and exciting profession, but also what makes it really hard for other people to understand what it is that we do. So we spend a lot of our time explaining what we do. But yeah, for mums, when I first started, I was very much focused on the physical side of things. So supporting mums who might have had back injuries or neck pain or pelvic floor problems or those sorts of things. And that's why I was doing my Pilates training at the same time, because I could use that as a tool to support women through that process as well. But as my business, you know, grew and evolved, it really moved more into the mental health side of things. And I had a lot of my previous work in occupational therapy had been in a more mental health kind of role. And I just started to attract clients that, you know, had anxiety or depression or those sorts of things. And so what I do with those clients is, you know, we sit down, we have a big initial assessment process where we talk about the woman and we talk about who she is and we talk about what's going on in her life and how the medical diagnosis of anxiety or depression is affecting them. And we talk about, you know, what's missing. So what could we be doing? What do you want to do? You know, what's hard for you at the moment, and how can we help you to structure your day better so that you can be doing things that can make you well? And what are the sort of activities that might help you feel a little bit more like yourself again and might be able to bring more meaning back into your life? And underlying that in this motherhood field is always as well concepts of attachment with the baby. So it's always about, we have to have that deeper understanding about how parents and babies connect and how important that is for both parties, so that we can use that information and give that information to the mums who we're working with, and use always be thinking about that as well. So, you know, in that respect, we don't want people to, you know, someone might come in and say, well, I just think it'd be better if, you know, I take off and travel the world on my own for 10 years. So, you know, as an occupational therapist, you know, that's probably not the sort of thing that we want to be encouraging someone to do. So having that understanding about, you know, building connections between mums and babies is really important as well.
And so how do people come to an occupational therapist? Because this is the thing, right? Like I've been diagnosed with depression and anxiety and was just put on a mental health plan, and here's the number of here's a document with all of the psychologists in the area, circled a couple, give them a call, try and get in, 6 month waiting list kind of stuff. So how do people find occupational therapists?
Yep. So because I am experienced and trained in mental health treatment, I come under the mental health care program. So with that referral under the Better Access to Mental Health Care plan, you can be referred to a psychologist or a social worker or an occupational therapist. But like I said, there's not a lot of us around that specialize in this field. So there's lots of OTs that work in mental health, but there's probably not a huge amount that are working either in private practice mental health or who are either working in mental health specifically for the perinatal period. So, but there's me, and there's more of us coming up every month. I get a new OT come to me saying, oh, I'm moving into this field as well. For me, majority of my clients come to me through word of mouth. They'll get referred to me by their friends who know me, or they've read my blog, or they've met me on Facebook, or they've met a person who's been my client. So I also get a lot of referrals from other practitioners in the area as well. So physiotherapists or Pilates instructors that I know who would refer people on to me. Yeah, the majority come through that way. So they'll go to their GP and say, you know, I want my healthcare plan to be directed to Sarah, because they're the one that's referring themselves to me basically.
Okay, yeah. Cool. Well, that gives me a better understanding. Thanks for that. Because it's weird, right? Like when you do think of the words occupational therapist, I think of, yeah, work cover kind of stuff.
And yeah, that's what I find is for people, you know, whenever I'm talking to a person, their understanding of occupational therapy will very much be linked around someone they know that is an occupational therapist and that might work in a specific field, or by someone they know who's had occupational therapy. So, you know, a lot of mums who've had kids that have had OT will just think OT's for kids, or someone whose grandma might have fallen and broken their hip and has had an OT come out and put handrails in the person's house so they can stay at home might think that's just what an OT does. And yeah, someone who's had a dad with a work injury will just think, well, OT will help him get a job again. So that's what I'm saying. It's really different profession in respect to what we actually physically do day to day and what the activities we do with our client is. But the underlying thread and what pulls it all together is our philosophy. And our philosophy is that human beings are happiest and living their most fulfilling lives when they're doing what they want to do. So when you think about all those examples that I just talked to you about, like a person who might have had a work injury, you know, getting them back to a job that they enjoy doing is really important. Or, you know, a grandma who might have fallen and broken her hip but desperately wants to live in her own house because that's really important and fulfilling to her. So an OT will go to the house and figure out, okay, how can we help you stay here? You know, we'll organise some Meals on Wheels. We'll make sure we get a ramp here. We'll take up all those carpets and rugs so that you're not going to trip over. We'll teach you how to better get in and out of your shower. And, you know, for kids that have developmental disabilities, like maybe autism or, you know, another kind of medical condition, it's like, we're going to teach you how to play. You know, we're going to teach you how to be a kid and how to play with Legos and how to run around and play with the other kids in the playground. So that's the beauty of OT, is that it's so different. And so you would look at, you know, a pediatric OT, you know, playing in the sandpit with a kid, and a vocational rehab OT, you know, measuring up someone's desk for a new stool. And you go, how do they even fit? Like, how is this the same profession? But it's that underlying philosophy that people are happiest and more fulfilled when they're doing what they want to do, what makes them what makes them life meaningful to them.
Yeah,
that's
so
what
cool.
It's all about.
Yep. Love it. I love it. Yeah. It just is a very inspiring kind of role too, because, you know, it's kind of like
I guess, everything from a coach to a therapist to a, you know, yeah, like
yeah.
physio to a, you know, like it's all encompassing, a real holistic approach, as opposed to just going to, not that there's anything wrong with that because I did it, it worked for me, going to a psychotherapist and, you know, that kind of more talk therapy. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really broad. It's really holistic. And, you know, sometimes that's our greatest asset, and sometimes that's also our greatest weakness as well in as a profession, because it dilutes people's understanding of what it is that we do. So that makes it a bit of a challenge, you know. And it's a relatively new profession as well. It's, you know, only been around for, you know, decades as opposed to centuries. So the profession as a whole really came into the fore after World War One, where it was developed to support, you know, returned servicemen who were coming home from war injured, you know, and amputees, and occupational therapy was created at that point, giving these returned servicemen things to do to make them feel like they were, you know, while they're recovering, to make them feel like they were doing something meaningful with their lives rather than just laying in a hospital bed waiting to get better. So, yeah, it was really interesting. I was literally today, earlier this morning, just listening to an interview on another podcast with Marion Keyes, the author.
Yeah.
And she was saying that she had a really significant bout of depression in 2009, and she had all the therapies and she had all the treatments and she did all the mindfulness and she did all the meditation and she did all the drugs and she did the hospital stays, and nothing helped her until she started baking and until she started restoring furniture and giving herself the time and space to do those things and just to let herself recover. And I'm like, that is exactly what OT is all about. It's about giving you things that make life worth living. Like, it's giving you something to do, and it gives you, you know, an activity brings focus to your life, and it gives you something to really focus on and to get lost in, so that you don't stay, and especially in the mental health sphere, so that you don't stay all up in your head and constantly thinking about what it is that you're doing. So I know a lot of people will struggle sometimes with the talking therapies because they just talk themselves into corners with mental health conditions that they just get over, just talking and talking and reliving the incidents that have happened to leave them where they are, or they can't actually, you know, conversation their way out of the way feeling the way that they do. So sometimes actually having activities to do, you know, it's almost like a diversionary tactic, you know, it brings the focus to something else.
Yeah.
Which is really important.
Yeah, totally. So back to your story, you were saying that you had been looking around for others in your field.
Yes. So, and I found them, luckily, finally. So I found this growing little group of OTs internationally that are working in this field, and over the last couple of years it's been really exciting to get to know all these people. And, you know, there's a couple of Facebooks that have popped up, one internationally and one that I curate here in Australia as well. And so it's just really exciting to see others in the field, and for me it was a real validation that I'm onto something here. You know, this actually is a thing. This is not something that I've just made up and have royally screwed up the idea that I can work in this field. So for me, it was really important because it was, you know, that whole concept of finding your tribe. So it was nice to kind of finally have people around me who were talking language and who really understood, and who I didn't feel like I had to justify myself with every time I spoke to them. So that was a really important part of, you know, my kind of journey. We have to use that word every time, don't we? Journey into this field. So yeah, and it's exciting now. You know, I've met lots of people that are doing this work now, and, you know, have sort of also become a mentor to some of those people as well, which is great. So yeah.
And so let's talk about the burnout.
Yes, aspect. Let's. So for me, you know, burnout, It was a real slow burn. Like, it was, and everyone else could see it before me, and I was basically in denial about how burnt out I was getting. But in the end, it was just my body was shutting down. So I developed adrenal fatigue. I put on 30 kilograms in 3 years. had very low frustration and tolerance levels. So I'd get really upset and angry super quickly. My sleeping patterns were disrupted. My eating patterns were terrible. I was, you know, just eating mountains of sugar and fat and crap food.
I was so tired.
And, it was funny, like it wasn't until I went, you know, and saw a counselor myself that she said to me, well, of course you are, Sarah, because your brain's just trying to survive. Your brain's craving fat and salt and sugar to just keep running. And I'm like, shit, that's right. That's why. You know, it's not that I don't have willpower. It's just that I have pushed my body to the limit and my brain is literally in survival mode now. So, like I said, it was a real slow burn. And by the time I realized I was, you know, in the depths of adrenal fatigue and burnout, it was hard to bring myself back. So I really had to do a lot of work over a good 6 months to draw back on things. So I had to give up different areas of my work. I had to give up different areas of my study. I had to give up lots of things. So I was doing lots of different trainings and trying to do lots of education into different fields of women's health, like looking at breast cancer rehab, and I was doing different parts of Pilates training. And I had to really kind of go, I can't do it all. You know, like I said in my bio, you know, I'm a recovered overachiever, and probably realistically, I'm a recovered overcommitter, because I don't know how much I ever really achieved, but I know I committed myself to a lot of stuff, and I really had to turn around and say, actually, no, it's time to say no. I had to figure out, I had to realize that I had limits. And that was a hard decision for me to come to, because I've always been the sort of person that has been like, I'm going to go overseas. I'll just save my money and go overseas. I'm going to quit OT and become a journalist. I'm just going to go to uni and become a journalist. And I've always been able to do whatever it is that my mind wanted to achieve. But just having a husband and two children and a whole different set of responsibilities in life made that really, really challenging. And for the first time in my life, I couldn't do everything that I wanted to do. And that was a huge awakening for me.
Yeah, well, having seen the way you weave baskets the first time, I can see that, yes, you are an overachiever.
Oh, yes, 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 yes. No, there was definitely not a little voice inside my head going, you're going to finish this basket first, Sarah. Definitely not. Yeah. And I am really hard on myself. You know, and that's one of the other things that my, you know, my counselor said, you know, when I was talking about what I expected of myself, she said, you know, have you always placed such high expectations on yourself than you do on others? And I'm like, that's not true. I don't put higher expectations of myself. I just expect myself to do a good job. But when I really sat back and thought about it, I'm like, shit, actually, no. No, this is crap. I would never expect anyone else to do this much work in their entire life. And if they did, I would be saying, don't do it. So it's really easy to kind of get blindsided by yourself. But what happens then, and what happened for me, is then that imposter syndrome kicked in. And I'm like, holy crap, I have let myself get so far down this hole in terms of my health and well-being. How can I possibly call myself a good practitioner when I let myself down so much? And that is one of the biggest things I've had to deal with over the last 12 months, is just really getting my confidence back, you know. And because I had to give up so much stuff and had to stop doing so many arms of the business that I was doing, it really affected how I thought about myself in terms of how I, you know, respected my ability to be an OT and to run a business. So that's been something really challenging for me to do over the last year.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? When you had said about, what was it that you were saying? It was, anyway, what it raised in me was when I had Own Your Awesome. And back then, it was pretty much exactly the message that I needed myself. I was so not owning my awesome. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But then in that, it creates this incongruence or something that happens where you feel like you're not aligned with the thing that you're teaching. And so then you kind of become even a harsher critic to yourself, because you're like, oh, look at you trying to teach these people to own your awesome, and you're so not fucking awesome, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Whatever it is.
That's right. And especially for me, you know, the weight gain was a really significant thing because I was like, what mum wants to come to a fat Pilates instructor? Like, you know, I could see the looks on people's faces when they came to my class for the first time. And I, in my head, all I could hear them saying was, what is this fat woman going to teach me about getting my body back after having a baby? And so that was really, you know, it was really destructive to my self-confidence. And, you know, it just added to all the... Yeah, it just added to all the doubt that I was having in my own mind.
Totally. Yeah. And I like relate to that on such a real level too because, you know, prior to, I mean, I've always struggled with my weight on and off through my life, but, you know, it was like I'd go up to 75 kilos, which was pretty much just on the border of what the BMI would consider, you know, heading towards overweight. So it wasn't even like I was overweight.
Yeah.
But for some reason I thought I was. So then I'd go to Weight Watchers and, you know, basically fuck up my entire metabolism. And also the depression and the anxiety, my occupational therapy became exercise. And so I would run and walk and do boxing and do all these physical activities to keep my mind, you know, in control a bit, I guess. And so, but in doing that, I became almost obsessive about it and I was exercising for 2 to 3 hours a day and, you know, and so then I had, and I was never like a supermodel. I was never a fitness model or, you know, anywhere close to that. But through the Office Collective, I started to get really tired and depressed and down on myself again. And because I was stuck there for 12 hours a day, there was no like, you know, way for me to continue keep up my exercise routine and the food started to slip and then the whole thing fell apart and then I fell pregnant and in my pregnancy I put on something like 35 kilos and then it's just never really gone.
Yeah.
Well, some of it has, but I'm still hanging on to an extra 10 to 15 kilos. And I have that thought myself, like, you know, when running the retreat, I was like, who wants to learn about life, you know, and doing life your way from someone who's fat. Like, and it's so ridiculous.
And,
it's what we
think, right? and there wouldn't have been a single person on that retreat this weekend that thought that, except for you.
Totally.
But it's, you know, it's just we are so conditioned as women to equate our weight with our value. And it's really hard to break out of that. It's really hard to break that thought process, even though we know that it's bullshit. But we still get that message reinforced a lot by society and the media, and so it's really hard to break it.
Totally. Yeah. And for me, you know, it's a practice and sometimes I feel like I'm getting better at it, but then, you know, and then I'll see a photo of myself and it will bring me back down to you need to diet. You need to diet. And it's like, you know, and then you're also when you're in this entrepreneurial space, you know, you're surrounded also, well, I am anyway, by people who are in that health and fitness space and are selling that ideal of a great body and what's wrong with you. You have no control. There you go picking up the sourdough again, you know, or the chocolate bar or the what.
Yeah.
And it's like when I'm on my deathbed, I won't be thinking, geez, Carly, you know, you spent your whole life fat. Maybe I will, but I don't think I will.
No. It's generally not the greatest regret.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting. And you know, that's part of the reason why I fell into this whole hustle trap was because I was, you know, following a coach who was in that health and wellness industry, but who was also really heavy on the hustle. And so that was that expectation that I put up there. I'm like, well, if she can do this and she can do that much workout and work that many hours, and that's what I should be doing. But it just wasn't possible. And for me, you know, that was just the start of the downfall and expecting myself to work so many hours. You know, when you're working 12, 14 hours a day, there really isn't a lot of time to put exercise in. And you know, myself as well, I've always been, you know, quite a bigger girl. I was, you know, quite stocky as a child, as people would say, but I was always fit. So I was always active. I was always playing netball or doing calisthenics. And, you know, as an adult, I started running. And, you know, before I had my first baby, I'd run a half marathon, even at kind of like, you know, a size 14. I was able to run a half marathon and participate in lots of different physical, you know, like personal training activities and stuff like that. But yeah, it just really, when I got my adrenal fatigue, it was the fatigue bit that really hit me, just that, you know, inability to get out of bed in the morning. So all of a sudden I couldn't get out of bed in the morning to go for a run because I was so exhausted. And then when I did get to the gym, I'd get halfway through a workout and just be completely and utterly knackered because I literally had no energy. So that was just exhausting. So in the end, I just gave up and I stopped exercising. And I had to for a while because it just was, every time I tried to exercise, it was depleting me even more. So I really had to come back to those, you know, more simple exercise, just like walking and you know, stretching and those sorts of things. So that was really hard because one of my big goals was to lose the weight that I'd put on over that period, but I couldn't exercise because it would make me worse. So it was such a vicious cycle there. Yes.
Totally.
And I'm still, yeah, I still haven't lost the weight. You know, it's like I would say I'm well now. You know, it's been probably a year now that I really started on my recovery process, and I feel well and I feel energized again. And so I am now able, you know, I go to personal training twice a week and I try and get out for a run once or twice a week and do lots of walking. And I've got the energy to do that now after not being able to do that for, you know, almost a year. But the weight's still not shifting. And, you know, it's like I was talking to my kinesiologist and she said, your body is still holding on to that weight because it's petrified that you're going to start abusing it again. It's not going to lose the weight until you can prove that you're looking after it properly and that you're not going to put it under that kind of stress again. So, yeah.
And this is the thing, right? Like, there's a level of acceptance that needs to happen before change can kind of occur, like meaningful transformational change. Because yep. We can lose the weight. And I've seen this throughout my life. I've lost the weight. I've been happy for 5 minutes before I become really fearful about putting it back on.
Yeah.
And sabotaging my behavior and, you know, and all that kind of jazz. And yeah. And it's like, I don't know, for me now, I'm just at this place where I want to learn to accept it because I know that even losing the weight is just, it's not going to change who I am. If I can't be happy in this body as it is, I'm never going to be happy in any body. Yeah. So, yeah, so at the moment my practice is really just trying to accept it. And from a diet perspective, you know, I don't really eat refined foods and sugars and dairy. I have a little bit of dairy, but, you know, not. And so it's – and I don't eat bread. And so it's like – I don't know. Sometimes I feel like some of my personal trainer friends are looking at me being like, well, you've just got to stop eating the carbs. And it's like, fuck off.
Yeah, I remember.
And then also I get people contact me after listening to me talking about this kind of stuff on my podcast and they'll be like, you've got gut health issues and, you know, here I can coach you through this and all that kind of jazz. And it's like, I want to be okay with it.
Yeah.
Not fix it, you know.
And even that, you know, even that is kind of frowned on in our society, isn't it? It's like even just being happy with, you know, just being happy with how you are at the time and not wanting to actively change your body is seen as something that's so foreign. You know, it's like, well, surely you must want to change. You know, that's the prevailing message we get given, isn't it? It's like, surely you can't possibly be happy at this size. You must want to do something about it.
Totally. Mm-hmm. And part of me just wants to, I guess part of me is like subconsciously staying like this to be a big fuck you to the people who tell me I have to be different. Oh, story of my life.
I know.
So what's in the pipeline for you? Where are you heading now?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. So I, next year my youngest daughter starts school. So I'm kind of, you know, given myself the rest of this coming year, 2017, to kind of just chill a little bit and just to be happy with the status quo, be happy with where I am, because it's something that I've never, ever done before. I am one of those people who kind of like sets a goal and achieves that. But before I've even met that goal, I'm already planning my next big adventure or my next big challenge. And that's a big part of how I went into that burnout phase. So I've got in my head a couple of ideas that I'm throwing around with what's going to happen next year. And I'm just giving myself the rest of this coming year to kind of go, you know what, just take a break, you know, just be happy with what you're doing. You know, your business is really running nicely and it's ticking along at the moment. And you don't have to be in a state of perpetual growth 24 hours a day, 365 days of every single year of your life. So I'm kind of just looking forward to summer this year, just to kind of, my husband's taking a big break over summer so that we can really spend some time with the kids and do a little bit of travel around the state where we live. So I'm really looking forward to that. And in the new year, I am just sort of looking to kind of expand my women's health practice a little bit more. So I've just launched my podcast, Meaningful Motherhood, which is just up to episode 3 now. So I want to expand and keep building that. And I really want to expand. I've had a few e-courses in the past around supporting mums in different areas of their life. And I'm looking at just really kind of drawing that back into just one program, which will probably be under the Meaningful Motherhood banner as well, which would be more of an online membership program rather than an e-course, because I think that just fits a bit nicer with where I need to be. I put way too much energy into creating e-courses and burn myself down into the ground trying to make them perfect before I put them out into the world, which is not the best thing for me to be doing. So I'll be creating a little membership program like that. And I'm going to do a bit more writing. So I, like I said, I was a journalist for a few years, and it's funny how after I, you know, got sick of OT the first time, you know, 10 years ago, I moved into writing because I recognized that that was a thing I always loved doing. Even as a child, I loved to write and I was really good at it. You know, that was the one thing I can say with all honesty, that I'm a really good writer, and I was a great journalist and I loved it. So I'm really keen to get back into that, but I'm actually looking at getting into a bit more of a creative writing kind of bent now, doing some bit of fiction and just doing something that I'm not going to put too much expectation on myself around being a business, but just more of being a hobby, which is something brand new for me.
Because hobbies are so underrated now. We just don't have them. We're trying to monetize everything. And so the idea of a hobby just kind of doesn't exist anymore. It's like, if you're not making money from it, it's not legitimate or something.
Yeah. And I have, and that has always been, that's also been a real pattern that I saw in my life, was that I would take something that was a hobby and I would turn it into a business. So when I was working, you know, in the country as a journalist, we had to do our own photography because, you know, there was no budget for photographers down there. And I loved it. I loved taking photos. But instead of just keeping it as a hobby and keeping it as something beautiful and fun, I went, I'll become a photographer. So I'll be a journalist and a photographer. And so I pushed myself to try and make an income from that. And then that ruined it for me. You know, I lost that sense of wonder and excitement about it when all of a sudden I had to put a price tag on it. And then, you know, when I moved into, you know, back into the women's health field and was doing Pilates after the birth of my second baby, and I loved that. And I went, I'll be a Pilates instructor as well, because that's a perfect complement to, you know, occupational therapy in this women's health field, and it'll be a great tool to use. So I made myself, you know, train in that, which was a massive 2-year training program. And, you know, I'm glad that I did it because I love that Pilates side of my work. But it's just another example of how I took something beautiful and pure in my life and turned it into a money-making scheme. So, yeah, it's really, really interesting the way things happen in that respect. So, which is why, you know, I've had on my mind for a couple of years the idea of writing books, and I was thinking about writing some books in terms of the motherhood side of my work that I do as, you know, I guess, earning potential for business and stuff, but I'm not going to do that now. I'm just going to do some fiction just for fun and just for my own sake, just to kind of not pressure on myself to be a published author and have that as part of my speaker platform and all that kind of thing. I just want to have something that's just a bit of fun. And like you said, you know, hobbies are so underrated, and as an OT, I know that, you know, I know, because that's what we do, is talking about, You know, I always used to say that occupational therapy was like the Mars bar profession, because it was all about helping people to work, rest and play. So, and play is such an underrated part of our life. So, yeah. So hobbies are the go. Let's all have more hobbies.
Time to kick up your feet and relax. It's on the couch.
Biggest fear?
Being caught out as a fraud, imposter syndrome. It's just, look, I know that it's cliche, but it's so true for me. That's always been my biggest fear. I've always had this massive fear that I'm kind of jack of all trades, master of none, and that someone's going to call me out and say, actually, you don't know shit, Sarah. Who are you to say A, B, and C? That has always, always been my biggest fear.
Totally, and I totally relate. When I was invited to speak at Pro Blogger last year and at We Are Podcast for two years, I just had this insane fear that there would be like an ABC journalist in the audience who would point out that I had totally got everything fucking wrong and I didn't know what I was doing after working with sound for 20 years. And actually it turned out that after that there were ABC journalists in the audience and they came up to me and they were like, oh, my God, thank you so much. That was so enlightening for me. People shove a mic in my face and I don't really know the rest. You know, and it's like, yeah, I forgot. I used to work in radio and I actually had to learn this stuff after working in radio, because they do. They shove a mic in your face. That's it. So I think we're so sometimes so focused on, oh, my God, there's that one person who's going to see us as a fraud, that we forget there's like 99 other people in that room who are desperate to hear what we've got to say. So, yeah. Failure. What does failure mean to you?
Gosh, it's funny, isn't it? Like I was always the sort of person who never ever wanted to fail. Like I can only ever remember failing one test at school, and that was a test that every single person in the class failed, so they made us sit it all again. So I, as a child, I never had failure. Like I was always successful in the things that I did. So I was not prepared for it, you know, and I think a big part of, you know, my whole burnout experience and what happened to me with adrenal fatigue felt like a massive failure. But really, you know, I just had to kind of reframe that and go, you know, I haven't failed here. What I've done is I've had to reassess my life and figure out what's important to me. So, you know, I could have kept pushing and I could have kept driving and I could have ruined my health for the sake of being successful in my business. But I really just had to come back to my values and say, well, actually, this doesn't line up with where I need to be in my life right now. So I kind of look at a failure and think, well, it's not a failure if you're choosing a better path.
Yeah. Struggle. What do you struggle with? What's your biggest struggle at the moment?
My four-year-old. Yeah, I was going to say my four-year-old's constant whinging.
Oh my God, I hear you.
Yes. What do I struggle with? Yeah, I think that's probably one of the things is, you know, struggling with. I really struggled with downtime, and that sounds so silly, but after I stopped working so much. You know, because I was working most nights, I was working, you know, 1 or 2 days a weekend. There was barely a day that I didn't do at least something on my business. And so when I set myself boundaries about no more work on weekends and no more work at night time, which I had to do for my sake, for my health and my family's sake and my relationship's sake, I found it really hard. And so there would be the odd sort of Sunday afternoon where I would sit down and read a book for a couple of hours and I would feel so incredibly guilty. And I'd be looking around for something to do. I'd be like, surely there's something more important that I should be doing now, because I just lost that ability to take time out. So that was probably one of my biggest struggles, was just being able to rest and to enjoy that quiet time. And I'm getting better at that now, which is good. So, you know, like even on the retreat on the weekend, you know, I think it took me about 2 days before I started talking to people, because I was just so happy to be there and not have to be answerable to everyone. So, yeah, I kind of just enjoyed that quiet for a little bit.
And, you know, recurring bitch. So, we all have this voice in our head that sometimes tells us a bunch of untruths about ourselves. What is yours? What is your go-to record?
My go-to bitchy comment about myself. Look, it's probably just another version of you're not good enough, you know. And I think for all of us, like whatever that bitch is saying, it's just another version of you're not good enough, you know, no matter what it is, whether it's you're too fat or you're too stupid or no one likes you or you'll never be successful or whatever it is.
You're a fraud. It's just a version.
You're a fraud. You're not qualified enough. You know, you're not making enough money. It's all just a different way of saying you're not good enough. And it's complete bullshit. So yeah, so I'm pretty good now at being able to kind of just let her have her say and realize that it's just it's just your brain being your worst frenemy, really.
Totally.
Your brain is just basically wants to protect you. I often say to my clients, your brain has one job and that's to keep you alive. So it will try to protect you from anything that it ever sees as a threat. And pretty much everything in the world these days is a threat to your brain. So it will always come up with stories and anecdotes and reasons for not doing something or for not being good enough. So you just have to kind of acknowledge it and say, all right, brain, thanks for that reminder. Let's just keep moving on.
And I think that's the key, right? Like one thing that I noticed, particularly at the retreat this weekend, was my ability to then have the other voice, you know? So the other voice that says, no, trust the process, you're doing a good job, where she never really existed before. I just had that, you're stupid. What the fuck are you doing? You've got no fucking idea. All that stuff going on. But now there's this other voice that comes in that's like, no, it's okay. You're doing a good job. Just keep going. And that's a practice, right? Like it's just acknowledging, becoming aware of the voice and then counter-arguing.
it really helps when you have, when you finally get that awareness that your brain is a great storyteller, and it loves stories and it loves to dramatize stories and it loves to embellish them and make them seem worse than they are. So when you can finally have that understanding that your brain's just telling you a story, and then you can actually kind of counter that story, or you can just listen to it and recognize it as a story and not as the gospel truth, makes such a big difference to how you interact with that voice in your head. And so often in our life we want to fight that voice, or we want to prove it wrong, or we just give into it, go, okay, that's right, I am a stupid cow and I can't get anything right. Or we rail against it. It's like, I'll show you, I'll go and do all the training and do all the study and be the best person I can be. And, you're constantly fighting with yourself. But sometimes the best thing we can do is just to accept it and just to realize that that voice is always going to be there. And just, I kind of equate it to like letting it sit in the back seat and be a backseat driver rather than letting it take the wheel.
Totally. Success, what's your version of success these days?
Probably quite
different to a few years ago, I imagine.
It really is. A few years ago, like my version of success was definitely, going to be having like a massive multidisciplinary women's health clinic and having like 20 or 30 staff under me and having franchised my business so there would be a Bloom Wellbeing on every single corner of every single town in Australia and being Australian Telstra Businesswoman of the Year. That was definitely my version of success kind of 3 or 4 years ago. But yeah, I've really pared it back now and to the point where I'm actively saying no to things that could possibly even lead me in that direction, because now my version of success is basically just freedom. It's just being able to have that freedom to have the space and time to do the things that I want to do, and the ability to spend time with my family and my husband and to have really quality, meaningful relationships with them, and to just have that time and space to just live and to just do what I want to do with my life. So, yeah, big difference in my definition of success now.
Totally. And my last question is always freedom, but I feel like you kind of just answered that.
There you go.
So freedom to you means having the space and the time to spend with family. And is there anything else that kind of fits into that freedom picture?
Yeah, freedom was, you know, how sometimes we pick a focus word for the year, and freedom was my focus word for this particular year, for 2017, and I've started calling 2016 my year of letting people down, because I felt like I just let so many people down last year by overcommitting. So for me, you know, freedom this year has been about just saying yes to the things I know that I can do and that I really want to do, and having that confidence to say no to things that I don't really want to do, or I know are not going to help me, or that I know I'm not going to be able to do, and being able to say yes or no with a sense of knowing that I'm doing it for the right reasons.
The plug. Instead of filling the podcast with self-promotion, we're being totally transparent. Here's the plug.
I have a podcast now, which we're up to episode 3, and that is called Meaningful Motherhood. So it's hosted on the Wooshka site, but, you know, it's on iTunes. You can find it there. Otherwise, you can find me on Facebook and Instagram at Bloom Wellbeing. So that's Bloom like the flower, Wellbeing. You can also find me at my website, which is www.bloomwellbeing.com.au. And you can also find me on Twitter and Snapchat, but I am never there. So find me on Facebook. Find me on Instagram. Yes. And find me on the podcast.
The takeaway: exercises or tips for positive change, sprinkled with salt and vinegar, wrapped in newspaper, and handed over the counter from our special guest to you.
I'll come back to that OT philosophy, in that it's all about meaningful occupation. It's all about living a life of things that you want to do. You know, we're happier and we're more fulfilled human beings when we're doing things that we enjoy and that we want to do, and that might, you know, are meaningful to us. So we don't always have to be living a life of pure happiness and joy, because that's not achievable. But as long as we're living a life in a way that makes sense and that's meaningful to us and that fulfills us and lifts us up, then you can't really ask for more than that.
So true. Thank you so much for coming on.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning into Carlosophies. If you really dug this app, I'd love for you to share it with someone who you think might also dig it. Really helps me to spread the word. And if you'd like to get to know me a little better and see some in-between app thoughts and insights and be around some super cool people, join my Facebook tribe, Show Up Speak Up. Search Show Up Speak Up in Facebook, or head to carlinimmo.com/tribe. Until next time, be real, be rad. Peace out.